As a crime scene investigator, I often come across people whose homes and businesses have been deeply affected by crime and natural disasters. One of their first questions to me is, who can I call to help me clean this up? Right here in Ventura County, Vortex Restoration specializes in water damage, fire damage, smoke damage, mold, as well as trauma and crime scene cleanup. They have the knowledge to deal with all insurance carriers and are a 24/7 emergency service and will respond during your time in need. Give them a call at 805-443-8055 and visit their website at vortexrestoration.net. Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Walzer Talk, a true crime podcast. I am your host, Gabrielle Weimer, and I'm so excited to be here with you guys because I have a special guest in store for you. I usually keep it kind of funny, gross, humorous, but today we're going to dive a little deep, and you're going to get your heartstrings pulled on, I believe. So today, the guest I have for you is the beautiful and talented Denise Hernandez. She is a supervising forensic scientist for the CSI unit and the latent print unit at Ventura County Sheriff's. And not only is she a kick-ass forensic scientist, she is a kick-ass mommy. She has three beautiful children, so you know she has her hands full, but she still finds time to do her career. She's an avid runner. And, you know, mommy to the fullest. So welcome, Denise. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Gabby. I'm really happy to be here. I'm a loyal fan. I love your podcast. I enjoyed the Boogeyman one. That was really good.
Awesome. Yes.
Yeah.
Creepy. And Denise, I've actually had the pleasure of working, I don't know if it's just one scene with you, or has it been just one scene? But I know we were out there searching for a casing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you helped us put our little scanner together. That's right. Yeah, metal detector.
Metal detector. All right. But yes, it's always a pleasure to see you at work. And I get to have you here at the studio. Today, ladies and gentlemen, Denise is going to be sharing a story on her personal experience and her take on the very, very well-known incident that happened November 7th, 2018 in Thousand Oaks, California. We are talking about the mass shooting that took place at Borderline Bar and Grill. During that incident, 16 people were injured and 13 people lost their lives due to this careless act. So Denise, thank you for having the courage and you know, the ability to share with my audience today what you went through, what you experienced, and everything that you saw through your eyes. So, all right, the floor is yours. You are my guest, girl. Take it away.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I mean, aside from talking about it with my husband, who's also in law enforcement, he happened to be there too, and my unit partners, I haven't had a chance to really have a cathartic moment about it. So Let's go on this ride together and see where it goes.
Let's do it.
I think you've experienced too, where, you know, if you're at a social setting and someone inevitably learns what you do for a living,
They
ask you, what is the craziest thing you've ever seen? And this case always comes to mind, but at a party, it's not something you're going to want to mention. You mentioned borderline, it automatically becomes a very somber thing, rightfully so, but it's not something you want to divulge in the middle of a cocktail party.
Right. I totally understand.
Yeah. And it comes to mind for a number of reasons. It's a very well-known case, as you've said. There's been many presentations on it, debriefs. So all of those details exist. And I just kind of wanted to talk about my little portion of this multifaceted, multi-agency, multi-day event. So let's go on.
Let's do it. Take some deep breaths.
Yeah, I feel like I do. I feel like now it's coming to the surface, you know, and it's like, this is all real emotion. So bear with me on that one. But so I remember it being a Wednesday night. If you have ever worked shift work, you know who has Mondays, who has Tuesdays, who has Wednesdays. And my unit partner, C, we'll call him C, was on call that night. And it was a normal night. I'm hanging out with my then boyfriend, now husband, watching a movie. And he's with the sheriff's office. I'm with the sheriff's office. So we're both used to having a work phone. And, you know, emails come through, texts come through, phone calls come through. You kind of learn what's, you know, just an update versus something that's more urgent. Right. And I noticed his phone, because he at the time was in the gang unit, so his response needs to be immediate. And his phone is just continuously going off. And it almost felt like this feels different. So even I told him, like, I think you should really check that one. Like, this sounds like it's important. They all are, but this one in particular just felt different. And as soon as he grabs the phone and he's looking through all the texts, his demeanor changes. And he's like, active shooter. This is happening right now. This is not a drill. This is something that's for real. And so he gets up, he, you know, quickly changes into like his jacket and whatever and leaves because he has the take home car. And because I'm CSI, our response is a little delayed. We come in a little later after the situation has been deemed safe and so forth. So I know he's going, I know something's going on, but a call hasn't come through for me. So I'm kind of like, do I get ready? Do I just lie in wait? What's going on? So by this time, there's already news, like the chopper is already out. They're covering, you know, it looks chaotic right at the scene. And so I'm communicating with C and other unit partners saying, have you gotten called out? I'm available if you need me, because it feels like it's going to be an all hands on deck kind of event. And then it's just like a waiting game. Like, what do you need? So then C and another unit partner, column A, they went to the scene. They're kind of figuring out what's going on there, because at this point, we don't know how big it really is,
right?
How many people are truly there, what's going on.
Are we talking early morning hours now?
This is still like late at night, still dark out. I don't know, like everything had just happened.
Right.
So maybe within like that half hour right after it happened. And then I'm advised that myself and my unit partner, Jay, let's call him Jay, we're going to be dispatched to the hospital. So if you've worked scenes, you know, okay, if you're at this scene, I'm going to need X, Y, and Z. If I'm going to the hospital, I'm going to need this material. I'm probably collecting clothing. I'm collecting cell phones. Like, you kind of get ahead of the game so that you show up ready, prepared to process everyone. And I expected there to be lots of people because you heard mass shooting.
Right.
I'm thinking lots of victims, right? So we go to the hospital and there's already police presence there. There's black and whites, but there's no chaos. Mm. And I'm thinking, where's the ambulances? Where are the people? Where's the family? Like, that's what I was expecting. And I'm like, I'm only a year in at this point, so I'm thinking, like, maybe this is normal. I'm not sure. So I'm being professional, but also, like, cataloging certain things in my head. And we get inside, and again, you're directed usually to, like, an emergency room or, you know, the doctor. Someone's talking to you.
Right.
And again, it's very quiet. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, where are all the people?
Right.
Where is everybody?
Right.
And it's an immediate punch to the gut where you go, they're not fucking here. They're not here. And if they're not here, they are there. And they are there because they're dead.
Right. Right.
And it was like, me personally, I wanted to just like cry in the moment, mm-hmm. but you're doing your job. So you can't. So you're just like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. What do we have to do?
Right.
And so then we can't leave because Sergeant Helis is at the hospital. And so we were told, wait, because we still have to process him and take photographs and do all that stuff. But we can't go in because they're waiting for his family.
Right. And so just like, so listeners know, whether he's dead or alive on scene, they're transported mm-hmm. regardless, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so at this point, we didn't really know what had transpired at the scene. So we didn't know what we were walking in. Everything's like happening in the moment.
Right.
And so then again, it's just myself and my partner, some emergency responding personnel, nurses, and we're kind of lining the hallway waiting for the family. Mm. And you kind of know why they're coming.
Right.
And it felt almost like rude, like, I don't need to be here. Like, in the sense of, this feels like a really personal, intimate moment. And I feel like we pay our respects, but also I'm really, like, you want to say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But you also have a job to do. It's a really weird combination of things. And usually as CSIs, we're far removed from all of the emotion.
Right.
So to be like full front and center with all of that, it felt very like you were privy to something that you shouldn't be privy to.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, like, you know, later on in witnessing the beautiful memorial they had for Sergeant Helis and everyone else, he was an amazing man. And it was hard to know that my first memory of him mm-hmm. was in that capacity. And so it was almost like trying very hard after the fact to try to cling on to every picture or every memory that people shared of him, because that's how I wanted to remember him and not the memory I have of him at the hospital. And so that was really, really hard. And so it's like, okay, you get in there and you're being very respectful, obviously, like you always are in every scene. And you're taking your photographs and you're trying to figure out, okay, do we need to collect anything? What do we do here? And that was a few hours there. Once we were there, we were asked, okay, where else are we needed? And so Jay, my partner Jay, and I went back to the scene. And at this point, now it's a more concerted response. Like at this point, now other agencies are showing up. Like VPD showed up with their Faro scanner. Right. Like every agency was there. Anyone who had hands to offer, they were there.
Right.
And at this point, FBI has been called in.
Yes. Like
their presence is there, which was so impressive to see. Car after car coming in with like 1-2-2 or even more people, with like young agents coming out with their jackets, just in full force, full presence. And at that point, it was decided that the ERT, the evidence recovery team, would be taking jurisdiction of the interior of Borderline.
Right.
So as much as we love to see all the gore and all the stuff, I was very happy that we didn't have to go inside.
Something to share on that really quick. I was away at training. My partner at the time, Kim, she got dispatched to go to that scene. And she was one of the evidence technicians that had to stay inside with FBI and work with them to help scan the scene. And I remember texting her saying, are you sure you don't need me? Like, I can leave training. And she's like, no, there's plenty of people here. We have plenty of hands. And then she followed up that message with, and there's no need for anyone to ever have to see this. So please don't come.
Yeah.
And so then that was that. But yeah.
It was definitely one of those, because, you know, we want to know all the details because you never know when our input's going to be valuable.
Yes.
But this was definitely a scene where everyone was like, if we don't have to, we're okay not having to, which is so opposite of anything else we ever go to. It's like, I want to see the nitty gritty. I want to see it all. I want to see what position they're in, everything.
Right.
Not in this case. So they took, again, they took jurisdiction of the inside, but there were still things to process on the outside. And it was a massive scene because people were trying to flee. They were trying to escape.
Right.
So there was different routes, different ways. They had it all secured. And so there was a blood trail on the outside that myself and my responding partners process. So we took the photographs, we took our overalls, you know, we put down photo markers like as you usually do, specifically of the ones that you were going to swab and collect. There was like a few items of evidence scattered around, but in particular, there was this instance where they were like, okay, we see some things. There's like a hill just to maybe like the east of Borderline where you could clearly see that people were trying to run away and maybe like go seek shelter or just try to be safe. And so you could witness the chaos just by the path and also the items that we found just kind of strewn about, like a random shoe and then the paired shoe kind of far away. Clothing, it was a Western night. So there was a lot of Western type items that we found, like flannels and stuff like that. You know, debit cards, just random little items that as you're running and fleeing, you're probably dropping. Right. You know, you're at the club, you're not going to be having a purse, you're probably in your pocket or whatever. Right. And in particular, there was like a phone and it's face up and you can just see notification after notification, like still actively popping up where they're like, initially you can see things like, hey, are you okay? Hey, why aren't you answering? Hey, what's going on? And you're just, you want to like open it up and say, I don't know what's going on. I hope they're okay. But if they made it out of here, it probably means they're okay. I just have their phone, but you can't do that. You know, you can't offer that immediate comfort. And it was just like, it tugged at heartstrings to be like, your loved one is fine. I just can't tell you.
Right. Parents.
Yeah.
Your sisters like wanting to get in.
Yeah. Cause it was different platforms. It was like, you know, cause you can just tap on the front and if they have the notifications on, it's like, you know, it's either a text and it was a lot of Snapchat and different things. It's like, so different people were trying to get a hold of them. But in that regard, it was just impressive how helpful FBI was. I think the old school stigma is that FBI is a little hoity-toity or maybe a little full of themselves. And this was not the case. It was, I don't know if they're, it's like a total 180 from any other stereotype I had ever heard of them. They were so willing, so helpful, and there wasn't any task too minute for them to help with. Gotcha. So on this hill, they're like, do you want help? And I was like, yes, please, because it's a really large hill. And by this time, my partners are helping somewhere else. Right. And I was like, I just need you guys to flank me and we'll walk the hill, and anywhere you see something, you stop, you let me know, and I'll take a photo and we'll discuss if we need to collect it. And they were like, cool. So I had a team of maybe like four FBI agents with me, and they were just, you know, scouring the hill along with me, super patient. If they found something, they would stop, we would take photographs, and then that's how we proceeded. Cool. But their presence was amazing. It was, they had all of the equipment, they had all the personnel. They had that like gung-ho, boots on the ground attitude where they were like, where are we needed? What do we do? Amazing for the how large their response was. It was amazing how organized they were. And I later learned that it's not one ERT team. It's like a small, dedicated evidence response team. And everyone else, it's almost like a collateral for them. Okay. So they work something else, and then something like this happens, and they get called in. And I'm like, and you wouldn't have known that they don't work like this 24/7.
Right.
They just were seamless. They knew their task. If someone, all they did was scribe, they were an amazing scribe. If all they did was photo, like all, they were great at their photographs. So that was pretty cool to see. And then too, like it was my first witnessing of multi-agencies within our county coming together, and not just law enforcement, but even like fire department was there, and they had the best snacks. Right. They had burritos. I was like, you guys, they're like, come on over. Yeah. I was like, you guys are all, they had the best, like, you know, like little setup. And I was like, you guys really know how to do this.
Is it true that, I'm trying to remember, but like, were Pharos, scanning was a huge thing, mm-hmm. and access to Pharos. Like, were Pharos getting flown in?
Like, yeah, they were like, every
hills, like they were choppering, yes. putting them on a chopper and mm-hmm. flying them over.
Yeah. Everyone who had a Pharos was coming in with their Pharos.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I think after that, they're like, we have to get our own Pharos, because the sheriff's office didn't have one at the time. Now they do. And now they're well equipped, and they handle a lot of scenes now. But yeah. Yeah. And that was a really long day. And again, kind of when you're in the eye of the storm, you don't realize how massive things are until the storm starts to die down. And then it starts to become nighttime. And then, okay, we're not needed here. We'll come back in the morning. They had the scene secured. FBI stayed there. And we had a chance to go home and try to get some rest, because we knew the next day would be just as busy.
Right.
And now we knew that there were several autopsies to handle.
Okay.
So you go home, you get some rest, and, you know, even with a regular scene, to come home and you see your babies and you're just like, let me hug you. You're my therapy. I don't want to talk. Right. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to debrief. I just want to feel the love and feel like everything's safe. Everything's okay. Everything's fine. Because that's my recovery before knowing we have to go back. And so then we get some rest, and we have multiple teams kind of handling. And it was like 24/7. There was a lot of autopsies to go to. Our ME's office is amazing. And so they actually had, I think, an ME from the LA County come and help.
Right.
So they had all, there's normally two tables and an extra one. So they had all three going on at the same time. And the way it was set up is that you had ME, the ME tech, or the pathology tech, one of us, sometimes two of us, mm-hmm. and then FBI presence too.
Right.
So we were taking the photographs, taking notes. The ME obviously was doing the autopsy. The tech was assisting the ME, and FBI was present to collect any personal effects, so that way they could return them to the family,
right.
and also do their own documentation.
And just so people are aware, an autopsy is not just like a quick general exam. They're very detailed, and depending on the severity of the case, like one body possibly could take up to, you know, 3 to 4 mm-hmm. hours. And so you guys have 13 bodies to mm-hmm. go through to examine.
Yeah.
So that, and I don't know if anyone's familiar with medical examiner's office. Like, you go into LA, it's huge. It's massive. Yeah. It's like a warehouse. Here in Ventura County, it's very intimate setting. It's mm-hmm. very small. And so it sounds like there were how many doctors present then? Just three?
Three.
Three doctors. Yeah. That's yeah. a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. It was busy, but also it was like, in the moment you knew the magnitude of what you were doing,
right?
But also, again, similar to the scene at the hospital and at borderline, you have a job to do, right? You know? And so that was also tough. Similar to with Sergeant Helis, it's like you're meeting these people for the first time, mm-hmm. and not how they should be remembered. And that was really hard to do too. Because I don't know about you, but for me, I have this habit where regardless of what scene I go to, whether it's suspect, victim, reporting party, and if they like, in my mind, I'm like, you're someone's baby.
Yes. Yes.
You're someone's son. You're someone's daughter, someone's loved one. Because if my kids, for whatever reason, if they were ever in that position, I would want them to be seen in that light too.
Right.
So not that I like baby anyone. It's just I go, okay, right. Someone loves you.
Yeah.
I don't know. My brain always does that. And so especially at this autopsy, thinking of the person who was in front of me, I'm like, you just went to work that day, mm-hmm. and you thought it would be a routine night, mm-hmm. and then you'd go home and then that would be it. And it's like you're paying attention to like details, like, you know, your brain can't help it, like right. their hair, mm-hmm. or their face, mm-hmm. or what they're wearing, or, you know, certain physical features. And you're like, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I can't help it, you know?
Right.
And also because, you know, I wanted in my own way to kind of memorialize them and go, okay, I know we have a job to do here, but you know, they need to be respected that way.
Yes.
And so again, later on with when all the memorials were going on and there was a lot of vigils and Facebook posts, which were very beautiful to see and very, for me, good to witness because it made me get to know them, how they were before that day.
Right.
You know, how much they were loved, to see photos of them doing things that they love to do, right. smiling, not the way that I got to see them.
Right.
Was really helpful in healing. And it was not something that you could like comment on. You couldn't tell people, you know, like yeah. it was one of the things you had to almost do quietly and alone. So it's really nice to talk about this today, actually.
Well, because you, when we get bodies that experience trauma, we are really remembering them or focusing on them in their last final moments. Mm-hmm. And you know, those final moments that they had were full of fear,
mm-hmm.
In a very traumatic way to die. So it is good to be like, okay, I don't need to hone in and focus in on
mm-hmm.
that trauma that they must have felt. Because oftentimes we do. It's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You
yeah.
poor baby. This should not have happened yeah. to you. Look at you. So you can replace those with like, oh, okay. They're smiling. They're happy. Mm-hmm. They love to go boating. They love, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Yeah.
And kind of like throw that memory.
Yeah.
Lock it away somewhere else yeah. and replace it with these ones.
I won't share like whose autopsy I was charged with, but even before we knew like the official debrief of how the timeline of how it all went down, the Emmys are very good about like, you know, documenting every wound, and you could kind of piece the story together mm-hmm. about, well, they must have been here then if they have these type of injuries. But,
right.
you know, nothing's official and you're right. kind of just sharing a theory. And so later on to hear the debrief, the official one, and to realize, oh, my God, so everything that we saw during that autopsy makes sense.
Right.
And it was like, oh, my God, another punch to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
And then also saying, you know, I'm very proud of the work that we did and documenting everything and getting through that. And also trying to make sure that after the fact, like you said, remembering them in a better, in a different light,
right.
you know?
Right.
But yeah, but that was really tough. And also, you know, they did all of the patrons that were at borderline and the employees first. And then they did suspect at the very end because he was also there.
Right.
And Sergeant Helis at the very end. So those were tough to also, I only assisted with that one. I wasn't charged with the photographs or anything, but that was really hard too, mm-hmm. especially with the suspect,
right.
because you have your own feelings, your own emotions about how it all went down. And, you know, the Emmys have to treat every single person the same.
Right.
They process it start to finish the same. Documentation is the same, regardless of who you are when you're alive at the hospital, when you're unfortunately passed away. at the Emmy's office.
Right.
It's all the same.
Yeah.
You know, and that was also tough.
Yeah. And that is hard because you look at the suspect and you think you caused so much pain and chaos and you just devastated hundreds of people's lives with your actions. But there is a mother or father, or someone who loves you that is grieving for the loss of you. And why?
Yeah.
Why did you do this to them, to everyone else? It's sad. If any way you look at it.
Yeah.
Sad.
And then, I mean, guiltily too, even now thinking about it, because I thought about it then, I still thought like, wow, you're somebody's son. Like,
yeah.
Your poor mom.
Mm-hmm. Your mom is.
How could you do that?
Right?
Yeah.
Your mama.
Yeah. Not only to everyone else's mom, but to your own mama, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And having kids, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
It's like, let me hug them and make sure I'm not traumatizing you.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that was a marathon of a day too. And again, super impressed with all of FBI. During that time, there was also fires going on. So yes. Like I mentioned, a lot of these agents were dispatched into the area. So they had to have hotel rooms so they could stay the night. And so a lot of them had to evacuate between the night that they were processing the scene and then the next morning going to autopsies.
Right.
So we show up and we're like, they're telling us, oh yeah, we had to evacuate our hotel room. And you're like, so where did you stay? They're like, in our car.
Right.
And I'm like, but you look fresh. Like you're ready to go. Like
right.
Great attitude. And they're like, yeah, we're just here to do our job. You know,
girl, you're FBI.
I was like, what do they give you? Like, why don't they share with everyone else?
What magic do you guys possess? You're not human.
There was no magic. They were just great people. So yeah, and then that was that. And then we had, you know, finally some downtime before coming back to doing, you know, processing all the evidence and getting reports done. And I remember that night after the autopsies, there's a group of moms that we all met when our firstborns were like babies.
Mm-hmm.
And even now we try to, on some occasions, get together and have like a mom's night out, usually dinner and just like chit chat and catching up. And so I was like, should I go? Should I not go? I don't want to bring this somberness, but I'm like, I also need my friends right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, yeah, just come on out. And they're very good about no pressure to talk, but also providing that space to talk, you know. And it just so happened that we sat at a table that was like a round table, so it felt like we're doing a round table. Everyone's giving their update, and they get to me, and I'm just like, last night sucked, you know. And I recounted some detail about specifically like the autopsy and how, again, going back to that somebody's kid,
right?
And it was just like everything finally came out. I'm like in the middle of this restaurant and I'm just like, it's all coming out. And now in hindsight, it was good that it came out at that time.
Right.
And immediately like the friends come over and they're just providing, you know, like mom hugs that only moms can give, you know? And so they're just like, it's okay. It's okay. It's fine. Like let it out. And then it was just like, talk about what you want to talk about and you can just leave it all there.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for that. Cause otherwise, I think we're really good about bottling, or at least.
bottling it up.
Yeah, compartmentalizing it, and then I'll get to it when I get to it, and then you're like, it's 7 weeks later. I don't want to unload that or whatever.
Right.
And then another thing that helped with that, there was a lot of, like I mentioned, like makeshift vigils. They set up a lot of memorial type things at Borderline a few days later with like crosses and photographs and. There was a huge community outpouring,
right.
Not just our local community, but neighboring communities where people would come in and just pay their respects, you know? And that was beautiful to witness in our community.
Right.
As sad as it is, a tragic event tends to bring people together.
Yes.
A friend of mine was like, you have to go. And I was like, I don't want to go. Like, I was just there. I don't want to return. And they're like, I think it'd be really good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Reluctantly, I went, and they had these support dogs.
Okay.
Particularly, her name was Lois, the support dog, the comfort dog. And all their job is when there's mass events like this, or even like, you know, cancer patients, they get dispatched out and they just do their dog thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was this beautiful, like, golden retriever with like beautiful blonde coat, just doing its dog thing with its little official vest. And I was like, that is the cutest thing ever. And dogs know, right? Pets know.
Yeah.
You know,
feel it.
And it came over and it just was like hanging out with me.
Mm.
And like, again, kind of like how my friends were like, I'm going to give you the space that you need
right.
to do what you have to do.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm here in public. Like, thank you, doggy. Like, I'm like, hide me. I don't want to show anything, you know, because as much as no one says don't cry, but also you don't want to be that guy, you know? Yeah. So I'm thankful for Lois, the comfort dog. I think it's still around. They have a Facebook page if you want to follow Lois, the comfort dog. She does amazing work. But that was good too, just to kind of have that. And then it was like, then you move on to whatever else you got to do at work, right. You know, you go on to the next thing. And then, I mean, our agency was really good about checking in and providing information as it came out, providing like a debrief before it became public. They released it to the public. There's been presentations at conferences, and I attended CHIA, which is the California Homicide Investigators Association, their conference they have in the Vegas area every year.
Right. And I love that conference.
It's great because it's a lot of story time and case study. Right. And borderline was one of the ones they presented on, and they did a very good job of having the investigators there, detailing the timeline, video, audio, the whole bit. And again, without sensationalizing it,
right?
Which is, I think, I love that there's an interest in, you know, crime stories and things like that. I dislike when it's sensationalized. You know, it's really hard. I think that's maybe why it's hard for me to talk about some of the things. I don't want to sound like that. I want to say like, oh my God, this is what happened. But it's also good to talk about it.
Yeah. And I think exactly why I have you on here on this podcast, because most people have heard the sensationalized story, unless you personally know someone that was there that night or worked in law enforcement in some capacity on this case. That way you know that these are real people. This mm-hmm. is a real incident. These are real feelings that are felt, aside from all like the legal aspects of how things are processed and handled in a mass shooting. I wanted to ask, I know, so your department was good about it, and like the debriefs that you said your boyfriend got dispatched out to that as well. So as a couple, mm-hmm. How close were you? I know you guys are married now, but at that time, like how close were you guys? Were you guys able to debrief together? Did it affect your relationship in a positive way or a negative way? And how did you go through those emotions together?
Yeah, it was very early on in our, it was like at the transition of becoming friends to being a couple.
Right.
And honestly, it was, we like mentioned, so Sergeant Helis has a very special place for me because I feel like that incident brought my husband and I closer together.
Right.
It was, and to this day, sometimes there's cases that I just go home and he was either there or he was involved somehow. And I don't have to go through the detail. I can just process. Hey, what did you notice? Did you also see, instead of going like, so what happened? It's like, that's out of the way. And we can just be like, that was weird. Or I need a hug. Yeah. And so I feel like, and he dealt with more of the emotion. He was at the initial response. And then once that calmed down, he was dispatched over to where they had like the families go and inquire about information. Mm-hmm. So he was dealing with a lot more of the emotional stuff.
Right.
Thankfully, like we didn't have to go to that at all, because that was hard. And he shared some stories about that too. And I think it was nice that we were able to be there for each other.
Right.
And just sometimes just kind of just be.
Yeah.
And just let it all come out. Well, for me, I let it all come out. He was there as like, you know, the strong one kind of holding it down. But I think for us, it actually kind of set the tone for future things for us to talk about.
Right.
Because it kind of let us know we need to be checking in with each other regularly, right. You know, so it's usually having, if it's like cases with children, that always affects me in particular, or a lot of like, if it's like a familial, like something between a family, that's usually like, I feel like I need to divulge or discuss, or because we have the three kids, you know,
right.
Be like, are we doing things right? Like, right. Point to consider. I know it has to do with the line of work that we're in, but you know, let's discuss it. So I think for us, it impacted us in a very positive way.
Good. So yeah, communication is huge. You hear all that? Couples out there, there are traumatic incidents that are going to happen in your lives. And so it's important as a couple to talk about those process mm-hmm. and be there for another.
Yeah. We actually met at a scene. So that's like, hey. didn't like it was professional mode, obviously.
Yeah, but, right. Can we get your number? What's the case number? Oh, we're gonna have another short story about that another time.
You can have us both on. That'll be great.
Yeah. Wonderful. I'm so happy that you shared. Anything else that you want your listeners to know, to have a takeaway?
That we have feelings too. I think now there's more platforms where it's easier to talk about our feelings. I've noticed there's a kind of been like a shift on social media, and I'm thankful that you're here providing that locally to everyone. Cause you're a super badass CSI and an amazing friend, an amazing chingona woman. So it's nice that you're allowing this to happen, you know, for today, for me personally. But I think there's been a shift in a lot of the shit that we see, it's okay to talk about.
Yes.
Not just interpersonally, because all we're going to do is joke about it anyway.
Right.
But, you know, to really let it out, and, you know, that's okay too.
Right. Well, good. Denise, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. You would definitely be a future guest on this podcast. Well, everybody, I hope you have gained a takeaway from this. The loss of a life is the loss of a life. Crime scene investigators are people who see some crazy shit, but we also have to process that. And it does tug at our hearts as well. I love you all. I'm going to end it right there. It's a good moment. But stay tuned next week for a brand new episode. And that's it. Have a kick-ass week. Love you guys. Bye.
Hey, it's Gabrielle. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, and share. And visit me at thewallsdotalk.com. We look forward to hearing from you.